SRN. Welcome to a bonus episode, Cinema Crispy, a bonus episode. I'm not too sure what it's called yet, but I will by the time it's uploaded, so this is a little awkward. Crespo Diso Film School, right? Drewster Cogburn!
What up, bro?
There we go. It's more of a lecture hall applause. More formal. Yes, this is, yeah, the Crespo Diso Film School. We'll just go with that because, welcome to the bonus show. We appreciate it. We'll go with that because,
I tried to do,
I wanted it to be like a recurring segment, a recurring deal.
It never
And we only did it once.
But, it never reoccurred.
But then the way we would have done it, oh man, it would have taken us so long to get through. The original idea was to pick a director and then go through his films and then, not every episode, but every couple episodes, maybe once a month, to do a segment on the show where we caught up with that director, what we saw. But then we started with David Fincher. Did we do Alien 3? We talked about Alien 3?
Maybe.
And then what was next, 7? We never even got to 7.
I don't even know. Perhaps. I don't know.
Ridiculous. So
we're lazy.
We are not lazy, just poor at time management. For me, you're lazy. You spend a lot of time laying about.
Yeah.
That's fine. I'm not judging. I like to lay about too.
Hey man, I work hard.
Absolutely. So you lay hard. Work hard, lay hard.
Damn skin.
That's a t-shirt right there. Drewster Cogburn. Work hard,
work
lay
hard.
Hard.
Lay hard.
Drewster Cogburn on the front. Work hard, lay hard on the back. Yep. Picture you That's on the point. Couch laying down, but you're just like, you're like, down, covered in work juices. I don't know what that means. All right. So what were we talking about? Oh, yeah. So we're doing a Crespo Diso Film School, right? And I wanted to bring it back because there's so much. I mean, film is more than just about what's out in theaters now. It's definitely more about than, you know, what's making money, how much is making what money, right?
What about what's coming out tomorrow?
It's more than about what's coming out tomorrow. It includes what came out in the past. Cinema history. There's a lot. There's a lot going on there. There's a lot to talk about. And I'm a big fan of directors. I am a believer. Well, you know, some people are more into the actors. Some people are more into writers. I mean, I like writers. Because I appreciate the shit that they got to go through, the bullshit. But I am a strong believer in the auteur theory.
Okay.
When it comes to cinema, which is that a film director, you know, even though a movie is like, bless you. Got any more? One more? Is it coming?
Oh, no.
Nope. Apparently, if you feel a sneeze come on, or is that a yawn? No, if you feel a sneeze and you touch your tongue, it'll stop it. If you grab it.
What if I just want to sneeze?
Well, then just let it out, man. The auteur theory. Anyway, sneezing. The auteur theory is what caused a movie is a collaborative effort.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of people are making a movie on some of these big budget things.
Yes.
So with the Transformers movies, literally hundreds of people have to make that movie, get together and make because of all the digital stuff, all the effects.
Some douchebag wrote it. Some other douchebag directed it. A bunch of douchebags acted in it.
People held up lights. People did the catering. People did. There's a lot of shit that goes into making a movie. People edited. People had to raise the money. People did a lot of stuff going on, more than just the one person, the director. However, somehow, at the end of the day, when the movie's done, we know it's a Michael Bay movie.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It has a style.
It has
his idiosyncrasies. His fetishes.
It's delightfully racist.
It's got his racism because he can't do nothing without being a little bit of racist, you know, for whatever reason. And so that's the auteur theory right there. Even though all these people are making a movie, at the end of the day, it's a Michael Bay movie, you know.
Yeah.
And you acknowledge the effort of everyone and you realize that, you know, without these people, yeah, the director can't do what they need to do. But the director can replace a lot of these people and still make approximately his vision. Whereas if those people got rid of the director,
Whole different movie.
Vision's gone. Yeah. Someone else's vision is going to come in a whole different movie. So we're going by directors for now. We'll see how many directors we get through before, you know.
My guess is 2.
Ooh. I already got three in the pipe, so.
Oh, because we already got through one, and we're about to get through this one.
Did we get through one? We didn't get through one.
Then one.
This will be the first one.
And only.
No, we'll definitely be doing more of these. Because the next one I want to do, because we started with David Fincher.
Yeah.
I want to go back and do that David Fincher next.
Okay.
All right. Then I think Chris Nolan after that.
Sweet.
Immediately after that. So that's the next three. Edgar Wright would be a fun one.
Yeah.
A short one, too. But for some, Spielberg, that might be a two-parter.
He's done a lot of movies.
But for some reason, I don't know why, I decided to start with Martin Scorsese.
Okay.
Big, big fan of the guy. One of my absolute favorites.
Who's that guy?
Who is that guy? Who is Martin Scorsese? Well, Martin Scorsese is a filmmaker of some renown.
I've never heard of him.
I think you may have. Yeah, I may have heard of this guy. So let's see. What do I got? What we're going to do? How are we going to do these film schools? We're going to go film by film.
Why are you asking me these questions?
No, because we never did any show prep. So we're going to start the show with some show prep real quick. How are we going to do this? You got the IMDb there.
Yeah, right? Okay. I have the IMDb of
obviously his
director.
Yes, because obviously he's appeared in some stuff. He's written some stuff, produced stuff. But we're focusing on him as a director.
Yes.
Because I'm going with the whole alter theory. Uh-huh. So we'll just do this logically. We'll start with his first.
Okay.
One by one, we'll go through them all that he's directed. And I'll start talking out of my ass and see what we can come up with. Also... Now, Drew, how do you think? Well, these are easy. I also have here a list of all the awards and recognitions, major ones for his movies. So when they come up,
rather you'd be like, rather blah, blah, blah.
Like, oh, boom, Academy Award for this over here. That's this movie. I also have a whole couple few pages of Scorsese facts.
Facts.
So, trivia stuff that I culled from the internet. I had to get rid of all the boring ones. Like
his eyebrows have supernatural powers. Like true or false?
No, that's true. That's the source of all his power. If obviously.
Yeah.
In the 70s, people thought it was his beard, but then he shaved his beard, still made good movies. It was his eyebrows.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Fair enough. So yeah, let's go. Actually, you know what? You know what I thought would be cute, too, real quick, at the IMDb?
Uh-huh.
They got that little biography there?
Yeah.
Born November 17, 1942 in New York City. Raised in Little Italy.
Nice.
Like you couldn't tell from his movies after all these years.
Yeah, seriously, right?
Right. Let's see. Wanted to point this out. This is something also I think we should. I would like to keep track of how these guys cut their teeth in cinema. You know, like who did what? Because I can tell you off the bat, like Robert Rodriguez, he didn't do film school.
Yeah,
he just went out and made his own movies.
Yeah,
and that's how he got started. Martin Scorsese earned a, and that's how you say it apparently. Scorsese. Yeah.
Scorsese?
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 Yeah, Scorsese. For years, I was saying Scorsese. He earned a BS in film communications.
Bullshit in
communications. He earned a bullshit in communications in 64. And trust me, if you get that bullshit degree, then it's on, man. And he actually went on and got a master's in film communications in 66 from NYU. So he went the academic route.
Uh-huh.
Which is seemed to have worked for him, gotta say. All right, so let's go ahead and... I'll tell you, let's start with the first movie, and then every now and then I'll just throw in one of these facts or trivia things or whatever as I see fit. So what do you got? What was his... Because even I have a little trouble remembering exactly what's counted as his first movie.
Are you talking about first feature length?
No, yes, feature length. Because he made short films throughout school. That's what you do. If you go the academic route throughout your undergrad and your master's, you're making movies for the school to show it there and obviously to be seen at film festivals. And a bunch of those shorts... got awards and stuff. So even from starting in his school years, he was a very promising filmmaker. So what did they have as the first feature length?
Who's Knocking at My Door? That Knocking at My Door?
That movie actually has a couple of titles.
1967.
Because that was that movie, and I saw this one a little while ago, a few years ago. Really don't remember much about it. No,
I've never seen it.
But that was, I believe it was his thesis movie from school.
Uh-huh.
It was a short film, and then he expanded it feature length, shot more stuff, made it a feature length movie, and that was his first one. But it was based on something he did in school. And, you know, I do remember, it's a black and white movie, and I do remember, even though it's largely pretty forgettable when it's all said and done at the end of, you know, by the end of this episode, mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll see. It's still, you can still see the touches of Scorsese, his style, the birth of, you know, where he was going to do a lot of the same type of shots that he does now. He did all the way back then. So, yeah. Or the way he uses music and things like that.
He knows the way he likes it.
Absolutely. So what's the second movie now?
Boxcar Bertha.
Boxcar Bertha. That was his first one.
1972.
That's his first, like, for hire gig.
Mm-hmm.
That's a Roger Corman movie. Roger Corman is the dude who had his own, he still has his own film studio, operated starting in the 60s, and it's all super low budget, just like the schlockiest, cheapest stuff ever. 50s, he did Little Shop of Horrors, black and white Little Shop of Horrors, you know, yeah. And it's like super cheap. It's awesome. It's got Jack Nicholson in a small role. But Roger Corman, he's great because even though he's produced a bunch of crap over the years, he gave a lot of people their start. A lot of people gave him their first chance to actually work on a set, work with cameras and lights, and James Cameron, who I'm sure will do one of these on him.
Mm-hmm.
He started working for Roger Corman, and he started building sets. And from there, he learned how to do matte painting and, you know, how to light a scene and how to direct a scene, blah, blah, blah. How to make an entire movie, pretty much, because that's what Roger Corman does. That's another form of film school right there.
Yeah, that's
film school
that's
by
OJT.
Fire. Yeah. That's what?
OJT. On the job training.
Absolutely. Yeah. OJT. OJT? I never heard. I haven't heard it put that
OJT, on job training.
But, that's how a lot of people started. Boxcar Bertha, you know what? For a while, it was on the Netflix Instant. Not sure if it's on there anymore. And then again, you know, it's it's more about what it represents in Scorsese's development than an actual movie at this point.
After that was Mean Streets, 1973.
Now that movie, that's where Scorsese really comes out, boom.
Yeah.
That's the real arrival of Martin Scorsese right there. That's his first movie with Robert De Niro.
Mm-hmm.
Harvey Keitel is the lead because they've been buddies. I think they met in school or something like that. I think maybe they're old neighborhood buddies. I don't know.
Something like
they
that.
Grew up together. Mm-hmm. But that's where he got together with De Niro for the first time. And he played De Niro plays like this kind of sociopathic dude. You know, like he's just a neighborhood guy, but he's also a little crazy in the head. You know, like he likes
a lot of his characters.
Like a lot of his characters, right. But this one's more almost believable in the way he's, because I've seen people act in this manner, a reckless manner, where he's just out for kicks, you know, mm-hmm. and doesn't care what happens really to himself or especially other people around him.
Yeah,
which could be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's a good one. It's good. I remember when it came out, Roger Ebert. That's when he was like really kind of starting as a film critic, right?
Yeah,
he started in the '60s in Chicago, and he loved it. He raved about Mean Streets. He was like, "This is the guy." Actually, when Mean Streets came out, Roger Ebert said, "This is in 10 years, this guy is going to be like the next Fellini."
And well, here we go.
And then Scorsese met Ebert at some point shortly thereafter, and he was like, "You really think it's going to take 10 years?" It's like, man, this fucking guy. But yeah, Mean Street, that's a great one. That has a great example of, you know, how he likes to play like some sort of pop song, but like a 50s or 60s pop song over like a scene of action or whatever.
Yeah.
There's a big pool hall like brawl scene that just knock him out, drag him out, you know, it's gone all over the place. And it's set to Please Mr. Postman.
Sweet.
Because some guy bumps into the jukebox and it turns on. It's like, "Please Mr. Postman." These guys are like psh, psh, beating each other up, hitting each other with bottles and shit.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. That's a Scorsese staple right there that pops up throughout his career. So, all right, let me see if I can start guessing now, because I don't have the list in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
After Mean Streets, very violent movie. I believe that's what he followed that up with. Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore.
Correct.
1974. Here we go. His first awards. Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. Academy Award. Oscar for Best Actress to Ellen Burstyn.
Mm-hmm.
The first of very many nominations and awards given to actors from Scorsese movies. It's a huge, huge list. It's pretty crazy. I might not have it here. Anyway. The BAFTA is the British Oscars. So for the British Oscars, it won Best Film.
No, nice.
Right off the bat. Burstyn won again for Best Actress, and supporting role went to Diane Ladd. You might remember Ellen Burstyn, people of our generation might remember her more as the mom in Requiem for a Dream.
Yes.
Yeah. That's like, okay. Oh, her, Ellen Burstyn.
Yeah.
Younger, obviously, yeah, much younger.
Rewind that clock 20 years. You got to say a milfier Burstyn, a younger, you know, better looking. Chris Christopherson's in it.
Oh man.
That guy. And what happens, on deadly grounds, Chris Christopherson. No, actually, not Fire Down Below. on deadly grounds, Michael Caine. Anyway, we're going to do one on Steven Seagal, even though he's not a director. We'll do an episode on just that's going to be a fun one. Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore is already based on Mean Streets and what's that first one? Who's that knocking on my door or whatever? It's a character movie. It's about a woman, a single mom, who she's just trying to make a life, you know, for herself and her kids. She's living out of hotels. Eventually, she meets some dude who is Chris Christopherson, and they're cool together for a while, but he turns out to be a dick, and it's like, oh man, I gotta get myself out of all this shit, you know. It's good. It's really good. I mean, it won a bunch of awards, and she's great in it, so I mean, I definitely recommend checking it out. I only saw it once a while ago.
Long time ago.
At this point, yeah, it has been, you know, it's been a while, but
I cringe every time you say that.
But it's a fantastic film, and I think he followed that one up with Taxi Driver.
Correct. 1976.
That's a hell of a back-to-back right there. And obviously, Taxi Driver.
It's fucking Taxi Driver.
It's fucking Taxi Driver. Like, what can we add to that discussion? Google Taxi Driver.
Oh, that movie.
That movie. So much stuff to read about that. It's a fantastic film. Again, working with De Niro.
De Niro acting crazy.
Two De Niros. And again, De Niro acting crazy and weird. That's something we need to keep track of. Exactly how many of them are weird. Because, you know, they're not all, but we'll see. So that's two out of two so far.
Just wait. You know, I'm looking at the rest of these movies, and I'm like, man. A bunch of
weirdos.
You want to talk about De Niro being crazy and weird? I think we just found them all.
We found a lot of them. Again, the BAFTA. It won BAFTA for Best Actress in a Supporting Role for Jodie Foster. Mm-hmm. 14-year-old Jodie Foster. Actually, Scorsese trivia, here we go. When John Hinckley Jr. attempted to assassinate President Ronald Reagan in 1981, he cited as his motivation a desire to impress Jodie Foster. Right? Uh-huh. That's kind of well known. Yeah. Whose child prostitute character in Taxi Driver he was obsessed with. Hinckley saw a Taxi Driver at least 15 times in the theater.
Yeah.
Also won a BAFTA for Best Film Score, Bernard Herrmann. Okay, now Bernard Herrmann is the dude who did a lot of Hitchcock scores, right? Psycho. That's Herrmann. Okay, guy did a ton of just classic work. Scorsese contacted him because Scorsese, being a lover of film, he's like, I want to get this great composer of classic films to, you know, score my movie. So he's like, will you please do Taxi Driver? Apparently, Bernard Herrmann only hears the words Taxi Driver. He's like, I don't want to do some movie about some cabbie.
Yeah,
like just rejected it outright based on that. I was like, I don't know. I don't remember how they eventually turned him. Maybe it was a meeting with the guy. Maybe it was a script. Maybe he had to show him a cut of the movie with like temp track or whatever. But they got him to do the score. He realized it wasn't just some movie about some cabbie. You know, it's fucking Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
And goddamn, won a BAFTA for best film score. And it was probably nominated too for Oscar.
More than likely.
And most importantly, for Taxi Driver, it did win the Palme d'Or.
The Palme d'Or.
At the Cannes Film. And it was also famously snubbed for best picture and director and all that stuff.
Yep.
But yeah, winner 76 was Rocky, which I love Rocky.
Yeah.
Fantastic movie.
It's
one of my
taxi
favorites.
Driver though.
Oh, it's not Taxi Driver. Man, that's a tough one. But still, anyway, there you go. So, okay, now after that 76. There was something in there. I think he followed that up with New York, New York.
Correct.
Okay. New York, New York is
proof. Once again, Bobby D.
Bobby D. 3 for 3, Bobby D. Bobby D, though, not so crazy in that movie.
Nah.
It's a musical with Liza Minnelli. Again, another staple of old school Hollywood. And actually, the movie itself is a musical. It's a fucking like 3-hour musical. And it's an ode to musicals and to old school New York. It's an ode to a lot of stuff in old school Hollywood. You know, it's a big ode fucking movie. And you know what? Probably my least favorite of all Scorsese movies. To me, proof that no one is perfect. No one's going to, you know, just bang out great movie after even good movie after good movie. Yeah. You know? New York to me is, it's ugly. I just don't like it. It's also, it's a musical. I'm not big on musicals.
No, I'm not big on musicals either.
If it was a kung fu movie, maybe it'd be a different thing. Maybe I'd like it more. Probably not. I mean, although Liza Minnelli and Bobby D engaging in saxophone based kung fu would be something. The movie was a critical and commercial flop. It cost a shit ton of money, and Scorsese had a horrible cocaine problem at that point. Like, really just was ravaging him. Part of the reason why the movie is terrible. Like, yeah. Because he made it
all jacked up on coke.
Coked out of his mind. And it's like, oh, this is... Oof, I'm not enjoying this at all. Is this what coke's like? Because then, if so, then no thank you. Here come the sneezes. Oh, no. Did you grab your tongue?
I'm fine.
Okay. So he was horribly depressed, probably contemplated suicide. He was just in a really, really dark spot and had actually sworn off making movies. He was done with it. The experience was just too much for him. He's like, I almost died, you know, from my problems and all this shit, my demons. And someone, I forgot who, wish I did a little bit more research, but I do know this, someone convinced him to make at least one more. You got one more in you. You can do it sober. And he followed up a horrible New York, New York with the fantastic Raging Bull.
Correct.
Yes. That was his comeback
1980.
Movie. That was his big comeback movie, Raging Bull. Ended up winning Oscars for Best Actor for, again, De Niro. What's that, 4 for 4?
Yeah.
And he gets pretty crazy, but more just like meathead, misogynist, douchebag crazy. Mm-hmm. So he's not like, it's pretty believable. We'll count that as crazy. So what's that? 3 out of 4 crazy characters.
Yep. 3 out of 4 crazy De Niro's.
Also won won the Academy Award for Best Editing for Thelma Schoonmaker, who I'm sure that name's going to pop up a bunch because she edits all of his films.
Okay.
She is old school. I mean, and emphasis on old. All right. Yeah. She's been around. And she's done so many of like just the best movies out there, past and present. Mm-hmm. So, that name's gonna pop up a lot. Raging Bull, also another famous snub for best director and best picture, losing the award being given to Ordinary People, Robert Redford film starring Timothy Hutton.
Yeah,
right. A lot of people love that movie. And at that point, people were like, "Oh, Timothy Hutton, he's the next goddamn Marlon Brando or some shit." Uh-huh. People were falling all over themselves with Timothy Hutton at this point. So it was kind of had that thing going for it. And then Jake LaMotta, you know, it's a tougher character to like.
Yeah.
The movie's really violent, really bloody. You know, it's like the boxing scenes are not that believable, you know, because it's very stylized. Mm-hmm. But you see like the close up hits, like fist, the gloves hitting the guy's head, and then like blood squirting out like someone's squeezing a ketchup thing. And,
yep.
And then he hits like the spectators with blood on the side, and the chick's like, "Oh," but the guy's like, "Yeah." It's like, oh man, this is a brutal, brutal movie. But then. Like someone pointed out to him how beautiful of a movie Raging Bull is. Like there's some interview or something I read a while ago. Like, oh, it's such a beautiful movie, you know, it's so grand and whatever and kind of magical. He's like, just look at that opening. The intro is so beautiful. And he's like, well, of course it's a beautiful movie. I shot it in black and white. There's a bunch of slow motion and I set it to classical music.
Yeah.
Well, of course it's beautiful.
You correct.
Know, I know. I knew what I was doing. You know, and don't give me that much credit. You know, I just these elements put together, and boom, you got yourself a fucking gorgeous movie. And that's what it is. It's ugly but gorgeous at the same time. It's everything that New York, New York is not. New York was trying to be beautiful, and ended up being ugly. Raging Bull was ugly.
It became beautiful.
It became beautiful. So in a Scorsese factor, you know, he draws his own storyboards.
Good for him.
Yeah. Do you know he's also a horrible artist?
I'm sure. Probably stick figures.
It is exactly stick figures. But even then, it's like stick figure actions that only he can decipher.
Uh-huh.
It's like, is this a stick figure or is this an arrow indicating next frame?
That's stick figure.
You know? Oh, that's a stick figure. No, that's Daniel Day Lewis. And since that was Raging Bull's 1980, I got a 70s fact here. In the 1970s, Scorsese had a superstitious fear of the number 11.
Sweet.
He refused to take flights whose numbers added up to 11. He did not travel on the 11th of the month. And he refused to stay on the 11th floor of a hotel.
Because he was high on cocaine. And paranoid.
There you go. That's that is exactly right. I would not be surprised. Also, my mom would love this. This actually delighted me a little too. Martin Scorsese has a pet Bichon Frise.
Oh, you and that stupid dog.
Named Zoe. I'm sure Zoe's the cutest little thing. Yeah. And let's see. I'll save that for later. Oh, back to Taxi Driver. He was in Taxi Driver in one scene as a passenger where he was like, he had De Niro's, you know, character drive him up to an apartment building. He's like, you see that window up there? He's like, my wife's up there fucking some guy.
Yep.
You know, I'll take this gun and I'm going to fucking blow him away, you know. And it's really, he says some horrible, horrible shit in that scene.
Yeah.
He only did that because the guy who's supposed to play that character got sick that day. And didn't have that much money to make the movie. He's like, shit, we have to shoot this scene today. I'm just going to have to.
He's been in a lot of his own movies.
He ended up being in a bunch of his own films, yeah. But he's
all uncredited.
He says he is generally uncomfortable in front of a camera.
Yeah.
But you know what?
I mean, he was in Who's That Knocking on My Door? He was in Boxcar mm-hmm. Bertha. He was in Mean Streets. He was in Taxi Driver. Well,
he's in those movies. Those are, again, like this necessity. Yeah. He needed someone.
He was in Taxi Driver. He was in Raging Bull.
Yeah.
He was in.
At that point, now he's going Hitchcock.
Yeah.
Because he played one of the old aristocrat families, like the head of one of the families in Gangs of New York.
Yep.
He's the voice of the dispatcher in the Bringing Out the Dead? Bringing Out the Dead. So yeah, at some point it became a Hitchcock thing for him.
He was in Quiz Show, apparently.
Oh, was he really?
Yep.
Gotta rewatch Quiz Show then. That's a good movie.
Yeah, it is.
All right. 1980, Raging Bull. Fantastic film. One of the best. If you're a fan of film or you're a fan of Scorsese, you gotta see it. After that, 1980, Raging Bull, he did... I want to say... Oh, that one's a little... Was that when he did The Last Waltz? Is that why there's nothing there?
No. That documentary was in 78.
Oh, you just skipped it?
Yeah.
All right.
I skipped all the documentaries. God, he's...
He does a lot of documentaries. Yeah, the Last Waltz documentary was his documentary about what was supposed to be the band's last performance, but then, of course, it did the old, we're not retiring. The drummer for the band is in Fire Down Below. Second Fire Down Below reference of the show.
There you go.
Take that. So after Raging Bull, did he go straight from that to King of Comedy?
Yes.
Oh, damn.
1982.
What? What the...
With Crazy Bobby D.
This guy.
Crazy Bobby D.
Three out of four movies there. Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, King of New York. That's fucking incredible.
King of Comedy.
That's a hell of a run. And so that's 5 out of 5. Well, that's 5 De Niro performances, 4 out of 5 for Crazy De Niro.
Yeah.
Is the character's name's like Jerry Pipkin or Pipkin or some crazy shit like that.
Yeah.
And he is so... Pupkin.
Rupert Pupkin.
Rupert fucking Pupkin is one of the best characters in film ever. He's a goddamn... He's out of his head.
Completely.
Completely gone. He thinks he deserves to be the next... Jerry Lewis plays like a big TV talk show host, like a Johnny Carson type, and he thinks he should be the next, you know, big Johnny Carson type, but it's Jerry Lewis's character. Again, and now Jerry Lewis is in this movie. Obviously known for being a comedian for so many years, for all the yucks.
Yeah,
he's just a bastard.
Yeah,
in this movie, but now we know. Now we know he is just being himself. Jerry Lewis is a fucking bastard, but he is a total bastard in that movie, subverting his image. And De Niro, just amazing performance, so uncomfortable and awkward the whole time. And then the way the movie ends, oh, it's just so good. Also, after that performance for De Niro, that was so much for him. He was like, I can't. He could not work with Scorsese for a while after after doing all those performances like that, and they're all so intense. He's like, It'll be best if we don't see each other for a little while. Which solely bears out because he doesn't appear in another Scorsese movie for like 5, 6, 7 years, something like that. Didn't win any awards. That's one of those ones where it's like not so appreciated in its own time.
Well, it's because it's probably too weird for people back then.
It was also satire. Satire is a lot of people, they miss satire when it's, you know,
done well and serious.
When it's done well and like for in their time period. And then down the road, you look back on it, you're like, oh, you know, like Starship Troopers came out at the time. A lot of people were like, this movie's stupid. But then you look back on it 10 years later, 15 years later, whatever. Oh, it was satirizing fucking the war, like war feelings, American patriotism. It was a smarter movie than people gave credit for, right? So the same thing happened with King of Comedy. After that, he did, I believe, After Hours.
Correct, 1985.
After Hours is starring the guy from American Werewolf in London, who is... his name Griffin Dunn is this dude who he's been working forever, but the only things people really know him from are American Werewolf in London and After Hours. I can barely even remember what the plot is about. It's like he's just out, it's him one night in New York City. I think it's all in one night. And he's like, I think he ends up trying to run away from some people.
It says, an ordinary word processor has the worst night of his life after he agrees to visit a girl in Soho whom he met that night. Wait, whom he met that evening at a coffee shop.
Yeah. So he's trying to hang out with some chick and he's hanging out and he ends up just like running away from people and it's a bunch of shit. He runs into Cheech and Chong at a couple points. Like,
sweet.
They have kind of small little cameos where they just act like themselves, really. Yeah. They're doing their Cheech and Chong thing. It's a weird fucking little movie, man. A little dark comedy. It's pretty good. I like it. I think King of Comedy is a better movie. But After Hours got Scorsese a Best Director Award at the Cannes Film Festival.
Yeah.
So some people like that one. After hours.
Yes, after hours.
After is when you get into The Color of Money.
Correct, 1986.
Paul Newman.
And Tom Cruise. It's a fucking movie right there.
That's a great movie. A sequel to The Hustler, which had come out 30 years prior. And that one's starring Jackie Gleason. And Scorsese tried to get Jackie Gleason to reprise his role for it. And Gleason's like, I'm too old and fat and lazy for that right now. So he centered it all on Paul Newman's character, Fast Eddie Nelson, something like that.
Yeah, Felsen.
Felsen. I knew Nelson was too normal.
Fast Eddie Felsen.
And Tom Cruise is a young up and comer.
Yep.
He takes him under his wing, tries to show him the ways of the hustle, and you know, it's a character film. It's a character drama, and it's extremely well done. Tom Cruise did it because he recognized it was an opportunity to work with Paul Newman and to observe him and learn as much as he could from him. No coincidence that he then went from that to Rain Man with Dustin Hoffman because he knew what he was doing. He could have been a lead in any movie he wanted. He was like, no, I'm going to play second banana to Paul Newman in a Martin Scorsese movie. And after that, no, I'm going to play second banana to Dustin Hoffman.
Why? Because I'm fucking smart.
Because I'm smarter than people, at least, you know, in terms of career and film. Well, apparently, he is a bit of a dodo in some ways. But in other ways, he's extremely smart.
He's a Scientologist, right?
Yeah. Maybe we should do a Tom Cruise one. Because that guy is interesting as hell. And then Color of Money, obviously. Fantastic. Did it win anything? Paul Newman won Best Actor. So, boom. Great film. John Turturro's in it. And so, like, another, like, a douchebag hustler type guy. The great John Turturro. Love that guy. And it's great. It's fantastic. Love it. I love Color of Money. Now, did he follow The Color of Money with... This one's tough. What year was Color Money? Was that 85?
86.
Did he follow that up with The Last Temptation of Christ?
Yes, he did. But before he did that, in 1987, he directed Michael Jackson's Bad.
Yes. All right. We are at Bad. Scorsese. I have it here. Scorsese directed 1987 music video for Michael Jackson's Bad. The full-length video runs how long,
18
Drew?
Minutes.
18 minutes? I have 16 minutes. 18 minutes?
That's what IMDb said.
All right. In both black and white and color, it is obviously just shortened down to the color. You know, people only see the color part when it's just a music video. But it has a whole intro with, you know, little squeaky Michael Jackson. He's got his little... And
Wesley Snipes?
Wesley Snipes is the dude. He's the leader of the gang. He's like, yo, we're coming through here, my parking garage or something or other. You think you bad? And then, so good. So good. Which then also fortunately gave us the wonderful Weird Al.
Yeah, I'm fat.
Fat.
I'm fat.
Maybe, that was a great music video,
maybe
too.
His best spoof video
ever.
Oh, man. Actually, it was pretty fantastic. Now that I think about it, all the fat suits and the...
Yeah. He had the fat suit, and then he had to have the fat Michael Jackson costume for the fat suit.
Yeah. It was fat Weird Al Michael Jackson.
Yep.
Ah, so good. So he did Bad. Fantastic, because, you know, if you're Michael Jackson, you had John Landis do your Thriller video, you know, and you had fucking Vincent Price do the intro. Now you're doing your Bad video. Who are you gonna get to direct your Bad video? Martin Scorsese, because he's the fucking baddest motherfucker. So then he went from that into Last Temptation of Christ.
Yeah.
So he used all that clout, that color money clout, and that bad clout. I don't know how much clout Bad actually gave him. But he used that color money clout and all that resurgence to finally make Last Temptation of Christ. He tried to make that since the 70s. That's one of his two passion projects that took him forever to make. And actually, I think I might even have another thing here about that. Something along the lines of how... Oh, he says that the only thing he regrets in his career is that he was only able to make The Last Temptation of Christ on a small budget. Although he... imagined it to be a grander film.
He wanted to make Noah back in the day.
Probably did.
But with Jesus.
He probably did, but instead he made Last Temptation of Christ with Willem Dafoe.
Yep.
Martin Scorsese says he played Judas Iscariot. So, you know, obviously. If you want to hear Judas Iscariot with a Bronx accent. It's not a perfect movie, okay?
No.
It's very arty, though.
It's got white Jesus.
It's got white Jesus. Although Willem Dafoe is a good actor, and he brings a lot to it, but it is still perpetrating white Jesus. But then again, Scorsese is obviously super Catholic, raised that way.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the whitest Jesus out there is a Catholic Jesus.
Yeah, right? Probably.
Maybe.
The Catholic Jesus is Swedish, I'm pretty sure. He's almost blonde-haired.
Yeah, that's one picture, right? And it's, you know, it's a good movie, but it's one where I would say it's a tougher sit for some people. You know, I wouldn't say that one's for everyone. It's not like some of his movies that are...
It's kind of weird.
It is. It's a weird film, you know. But it's definitely something that would have to be seen if you want to know your Scorsese.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now this is where I get a little flummoxed, because that was 87? No, yeah. 88? 87.
88.
Did he go right to Goodfellas from there?
Yes.
All right, because that was 1990. And right to Goodfellas. Everyone knows Goodfellas. If you haven't seen Goodfellas yet, just stop.
Go watch it. Come back.
Go online, find it, rent it, buy it, do what you got to do. Watch Goodfellas. Come back. Start the podcast from the beginning. Because now you have a proper frame of reference. Goodfellas. There are no perfect movies.
This one gets close.
Goodfellas is all pretty much as close as it fucking gets.
It gets close.
It is so good. Obviously, I'm not talking about...
Yeah, it's one of those
technical things. Like, this scene, he was holding the cup, and then the next scene, the cup's on the table, but now it's back in the sand. I'm not talking about shit like that. Continuity stuff. Yeah, that's bullshit. The movie is fucking amazing.
Yeah.
Right. It's fucking Goodfellas.
Yeah.
Best Supporting Actor, Joe Pesci. And it's amazing that's the only Oscar that movie won.
Yeah, it is, actually. Well, it is very, very violent.
Very violent, but still nominated for everything.
Yeah.
Very violent. Oh, well, the movie that ended up winning was very violent, too. Dances with Wolves.
Yeah.
That movie has its scenes of blood and a little bit of blood and gore. It was about the engines. It was about the white man and his white guilt.
Yep.
So Kevin Costner and Dances with Wolves got that award instead of the fantastic Goodfellas. It did win the BAFTA for best film, best direction, best screenplay, best editing, best cast. The Brits got it right.
Yep, they were like, hey, we know what's going on here.
And it won the Silver Lion for best direction at the Venice Film Festival.
Nice.
That's Venice. It's Goodfellas. I mean, what can we say about it that hasn't been said about it?
Already? Nothing.
Right? It's one where he casts his mom as Joe Pesci's mom. You know, the scene where they stop. He's like, I need a knife because they got the body. And she's like, no, eat. It's like 3 a.m. And he's like, no, I got food. And she makes a bunch of food. That's his mom.
Okay.
She pops up in a couple more movies, like in a motherly capacity.
Nice.
That's sweet. Her name's Catherine. Oh, okay, here we go. She has cameos in Casino. Mm-hmm. The Age of Innocence, Cape Fear, King of Comedy, Mean Streets. I'm going all the way back. Who's knocking at my door?
Nice.
And yeah, it's fucking Goodfellas, man. It's fucking Goodfellas. Just go
see the Return of Bobby D.
Just go what? Yeah. There you go. So when was King of Comedy? 84, 83?
King of Comedy was 82.
82. 8 years between getting back together. Finally. They're like, all right, we can work together again without me having night terrors.
Yeah,
and he plays a mob guy who is not really crazy. He does kind of have a little like paranoia descent at the end there, and he starts bumping people off. Mm-hmm. But that's not really him acting crazy. I mean, it's not like the crazy.
No, it's not
Travis Bickle or it's not these over the top characters. It's much more internal, actually incredibly internal. Like there's the scene where De Niro, his character, decides that he's gonna kill everyone that was involved in a Lufthansa heist. It's a scene where he's at the bar and he's smoking a cigarette. And some guy's talking to him about something completely different. And he's looking at this guy. The guy with the wigs. Mitch, whatever his name was.
Remember.
The guy who wanted to have the wig shop. And he kept bugging him for the money. Where's my money? Where's my money? He's looking at him from across the bar. And what kicks in? Cream. And it's 30 seconds. Pushing in really slowly at Martin Scorsese. Robert De Niro. And he's holding a cigarette, and he's like pretending to listen to the guy talk, and he's looking at the other guy, and it's just in his eyes going back and forth, and he's just thinking. It's just 30 seconds of him thinking, but that's the moment he decides to kill everybody, and it's completely just internal moment. Just his eyes moving around, and he's like smoking a cigarette.
I'm gonna kill these guys.
And then from that point on, it becomes a bloodbath for anyone involved. Spoiler alert. It's so good. Please see the movie, people. After Goodfellas, I think is when he went Age of Innocence.
Sir. 1991, Cape Fear.
Cape Fear. Okay, this is
the return of Crazy Bobby D.
Yes, absolutely. This is a time period where the movie order gets a little wonky for me. Absolutely, the return of Crazy Bobby D. So that's now 4 out of 6 Crazy Bobby D.
I think it's 5 out of 7.
5 out of 7. Thank you. And oh man. He's got that crazy accent. Was it supposed to, like similar sort southern accent?
Know.
That was the beginning of. I feel like that was the start of De Niro's desire to get into accent work because, like, he had that weird accent in that Men of Honor movie, and you know, just like, I don't know. But still, pretty over the top of that. A remake of obviously the original Cape Fear, starring Robert Mitchum and Gregory Peck, who at that time two huge titans of cinema. So for Robert De Niro, they teamed him up with Nick Nolte, who at that time was a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
Nick Nolte plays the Gregory Peck role of the lawyer, father type. De Niro is the Robert Mitchum role, where he's the ex-con, who's now, he's like, come for your counselor and your daughter. and he sticks his finger in Juliette Lewis's mouth. And
yep.
Pretty creepy. Yeah, it had some pretty creepy scenes in that movie. And it's got the classic Cape Fear theme. That's another one where Scorsese, that's his first remake, not his last. It is his first remake, Cape Fear. And that's, again, something that shows his love of old school cinema because he's reusing the theme score. He's like, why? What am I even going to bother? We already have the perfect score.
We'll just use it.
We'll just use it because, I mean, it's Cape Fear. The original Cape Fear is pretty damn good. It's pretty damn good. But, I mean, we're talking Scorsese came for your 90s Scorsese, too, so it's fucking visceral.
Yeah.
You know, it's in your face. And
Crazy Bobby D.
And Crazy Bobby D. And very wet at the end. Very wet.
Yeah, yes. Yes, very.
Around this time, John Woo made the fantastic film The Killer. Mm-hmm. I think that was more like 89, 90, something like that. And on the commentary track he did for a movie's DVD a while ago, John Woo said he dedicated his movie to Martin Scorsese.
Nice.
But then The Killer is a fucking... Man, that's damn good. That's a damn good movie. So then was Age of Innocence after Cape Fear?
Yes, 93.
Okay, because now he was like, I need to make a drama of manners. A costume drama. It is his first time working with Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yes, not his last.
Not his last. First, not his last.
And this girl named Winona Ryder.
Some Winona Ryder.
Who people think had talent at one point in time.
Enough talent at least to pull off an accent of some sort. You're like, no, this is... She could put butt in seats, though. She did for a little while. She's coming off that Beetlejuice and Heather's push.
Yeah.
So, she was a bit of a known commodity in Hollywood. Like a bankable thing, Winona Ryder. Shout out to Jisak, who wrote a song, Winona Ryder, I Want a Ryder. It's pretty
sweet.
The Winona Ryder song. That was a chorus, Winona Ryder, I Want a Ryder. That was pretty funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's Age of Innocence. I mean, it's a costume drama. It's, you know what? I do know this. Someone who was, it was for There Will Be Blood, right?
Mm-hmm.
They needed to cast a son for There Will Be Blood. P.T. Anderson's There Will Be Blood for H.W. Plainview. You know, Daniel, yes. Plainview is Daniel Day-Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
And then he needed a younger kid for the son. They found a kid that they liked. And, you know, he auditioned and they liked him. So, all right, this is going to work out great. The kid's mom went out and rented Gangs of New York.
Nah.
Right? And then saw Daniel Day-Lewis's Bill the Butcher, Raving Maniac. We'll talk about that in a little bit. And she was like, she called up the people. Like, I don't want my son working with this man. He's a lunatic.
Go watch Age of Innocence.
They sent her a copy of Age of Innocence, where he played a very genteel man of, you know, proper upbringing, yes. Blah, blah, blah. And she's like, oh, okay. He's an actor. Oh,
yes,
I get it.
Yes, he is just a very convincing actor.
One of my cousins, when he won the best actor for My Left Foot, and he came walking down the aisle, one of my cousins was like, what the fuck? The guy's walking.
Yeah. Actor. I am an actor. Every time I act, they give me an award. My name is Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yes, exactly, right? Did he win for anything for Age of Innocence? Let's see. He may have been nominated, but he didn't win nothing.
He won the Daniel Day-Lewis Award for Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh, yeah, they were giving that out at that time. So it did win for Best Costume Design.
Of course.
Okay, so there you go. And Miriam Margolyes won Supporting Actress, BAFTA, the BAFTA. So Age of Innocence, you know, it's definitely one where people should see it just because it's a different Scorsese. It's not the raging lunatic Scorsese or even the... It's almost like the only reason to watch New York, New York for me.
It's
the musical Scorsese, yeah. And it's also the most coked up Scorsese there is. So it's worth watching for as that kind of artifact alone. Right, Age of Innocence. It's a different mode. Him doing a different thing, and you know, it is what it is. It's all right. So, Age of Innocence. Now, okay, did he follow that up with? Because that was 93, right? Follow that up with Age of Innocence. I think Bringing Out the Dead was later in the 90s. That may have been his last 90s movie. Was there something else? Did he do Kundun? Is that when he did Kundun?
Casino, bro.
Casino!
1995. Casino! Come on! The return of Bobby D and Joe Pesci as gangsters together.
That's
another one of those awesome freaking... It's one of his better movies, Chris.
I deserve that.
Yeah.
I deserve that. Casino! Sitting on top of my television.
Yes.
Because I've been getting ready to revisit Casino.
It's an awesome movie.
It's damn good. Okay, now it did come out. It's 95.
Oh, the scene with the baseball bats at the end.
Oh, Jesus. That scene's hard for me to watch, man. When, spoiler alert. when they destroy Joe Pesci's
face
and his brother.
Yeah.
And they throw him in a pit, both alive. And, ugh.
Yeah. And start burying him. Yeah.
And then he's like, no, my brother, he's still alive. Yeah. Stop, he's still alive. And he's like, they're just ding, ding, ding. Like, oh my God, it's so hard to watch. It's a brutal, brutal movie. Amazing movie. Now we're 8 out of 8 with De Niro Scorsese.
Something like that.
I think that's it. That's the last time they worked together. And then that is not...
Once again, not necessarily crazy, not, just gangster.
Yeah, not crazy. He's a gangster dude. Although he wasn't actually a gangster, he just had some gangster mentalities and, you know, lived a little illicitly on the legal side. But he wasn't really a gangster. Joe Pesci, he played a gangster. Yeah. And he was fucking out. His character was out of his mind. Now, you know, obviously the movie gets compared to Goodfellas because it's those two guys. It involves the mafia. It has voiceover narration, which Scorsese does like almost no other. You know, voiceover. I feel like I hate voiceover in movies for the most part. It's like a crutch, a storytelling crutch. That's like you can't tell your movie visually. You have to have someone explaining it to you. But the way Scorsese does it, it's just I don't know, man. It's different. It's weird how he nails that the art of the voiceover. And Casino is fucking voiceover wall to wall.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's crazy. But it's jumping from character perspective to character, and oh man, so such an epic story. So many twists and turns and things here and there. Obviously, it helps that it's based on you know, true life stuff. Just like Goodfellas, a lot of his best movies based on true life stuff. Because you know what? What's crazier than reality?
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. So then he did Kundun.
Yes, 97.
Kundun is about Tibet, you know, the Dalai Lama,
yeah,
and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
This is very interesting. He is listed as one of 50 people barred from entering Tibet.
Interesting.
Yes. Disney, they actually released the movie, clashed with Chinese officials over the film.
Well, because I'm sure at that point in time it was with...
Well, I mean, it's all about...
Chinese have been oppressing Tibet for how long?
For as long as Tibet's been around, pretty much, and they've been trying to ethnically cleanse them and wipe them off the map and pretend they never existed.
Yep.
It's just little fucking Tibet, man.
Seriously, they just hang out in the mountains.
Just leave them alone, China. Leave them alone, China! Bunch of bullies. But yeah, he you know, Kundun is, again, it's like Age of Innocence or New York. It's Scorsese in a different mode, in a different drive. It's another biopic for him, just like Raging Bull and I guess, you know, and Goodfellas. Goodfellas is definitely a biopic. But again, it's not one where it's like, it's not immediately accessible. It's not a mainstream movie. It's him doing something that he wanted to do. It's a one for him type of, one for him. Casino is more of a one for you. Here's a much more fun, exciting movie. Now here's one for me. Here's Kundun. Going back, Casino did win the Golden Globe for Best Actress for Sharon Stone. But the Golden Globes are a bunch of bullshit, so.
Yep.
Kundun didn't win shit. And then after that, I believe it was a couple years before he put out Bringing Out the Dead.
Correct, 99.
99. 99 was a good year for movies.
Yeah,
99 with American Beauty, that, Fight Club, other stuff as well. The Matrix, I believe. Kundun, we just saw that Kundun. Bringing Out the Dead, Nicolas Cage.
Being all crazy.
That's like 7 crazy De Niro performances just packed together and stuffed into Nicolas Cage. Because that's Nicolas Cage, man. His mega acting. That's He's doing his thing. And then because it's a guy who's doing a lot of driving and also descending into madness, it gets unfairly compared to Taxi Driver. Because it's like, oh, Scorsese's back with you know, a guy driving at night movie in New York. You know,
the guy is crazy.
So ooh, it's just like you know, it's a completely different thing. It's Nicolas Cage character. I think he's on like, I'm pretty sure it's split up into shifts. I think it goes on 3 different shifts because he ends up with 3 different partners throughout the night. One of them is Tom Sizemore. One of them is Vin Rames, who's like all about like, oh Jesus, he's doing that thing the whole time. And the third one is can't remember. No idea.
Sweet.
It's good. I mean, I really like it.
I like it too.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. Yeah, fun's a good word for it because it's a lot of energy. It's very high energy. It's a crazy story. Again, Nick Cage is bringing it. I think Mark Anthony plays a homeless guy that they keep bringing in.
Sweet.
And Bringing Out the Dead. I think that's one that people need to revisit more as a Scorsese, possible Scorsese classic. I think it should be considered. Totally. I don't know, like not up there with Taxi Driver and Goodfellas.
No, definitely at the bottom.
But
not at the bottom, but
not at the bottom, but yeah.
Bottom of the great stuff.
Yeah, the bottom of the great stuff. I would say like at the bottom of that tier or at the very, very top of the next tier. Like it's really, really, really good movies that aren't necessarily great, but still so close. So close. Ah, it's right there. After Bringing Out the Dead, I believe that's when he finally got to do his other lifelong dream fucking project, Gangs of New York.
Correct.
That's another one. That and Temptation of Christ.
And that's when he started his kick with DiCaprio.
And that's
that he's been on ever since.
That's the new De Niro. This is DiCaprio. Actually, right around that time when he was doing Gangs of New York, he was thinking like, I'm finally getting to make this movie. I think I'm done. After Gangs of New York, there are other stories I've always wanted to tell or whatever, but I mean, at that point, he was in his early 60s, I think, and he was like, I could feel myself winding down here. Mm-hmm. And then he cast DiCaprio in the movie. I wouldn't be surprised, too, if he cast DiCaprio at the time, because studios will do this to you always if you're making a movie. Here's your list of actors. You want $125 million to make this movie? Here's your list
of
actors.
One of these people is going
to
be in it.
You need one of these people. You can't get these people. You want to use someone else? That's fine. We're taking $30 million off that budget. You fucking figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So I wouldn't be surprised if DiCaprio was one of them because he wanted to make this fucking movie. So I'm sure DiCaprio was like, you use this guy. He's your guy. But then he meets the kid. Because at this point, DiCaprio's still kind of a kid.
Yeah.
He meets the kid. Finds out, oh shit.
He can act.
He loves, even though he's not the best part of Gangs of New York. I think of all his acting he does with Scorsese, Gangs of New York is his lesser performance. But the kid loves film. He's a student of film just like Scorsese.
Yes.
He's crazy about movies. And he has a gusto and a verve for making movies.
He had been making movies for so long.
At that point, he had been making them for a while. And you know who actually, now that I remember, who really like sealed the deal for DiCaprio getting the movie, getting the role in Gangs of New York? Robert De Niro, because they worked together on This Boy's Life, where he played his son. And of course, I was like, what do you know about this guy? I mean, you worked with him, what can you tell me? And De Niro's like, he's the real deal. Trust me on that one. Cast him. He reinvigorated Scorsese, because the love of cinema, the love of film is a very infectious thing. It's like a disease. It's like the strain. It's like little worms that get into you and they tick you over sometimes.
Sweet.
And sometimes that shit goes dormant and then, you know, it's another person comes along with that fire and it reignites that fire, that love for the art. Happens like that with any art form, right? But cinema, it's strong. And it got Scorsese going again. It fucking 14 years later, still making movies, so thank God for DiCaprio for that. That might be the best thing DiCaprio's ever done with his life, ever.
Yeah. Perhaps.
So you might as well just stop doing stuff.
Unless it's movies with Martin Scorsese.
And of course, it's Gangs of New York. It's a great, great movie. He originally, when he thought of the idea, but when he read the book that he ended up becoming the movie back in the 70s, he wanted De Niro to play Bill the Butcher. But by the time he was able to get around to making it, they decided he was too old for it.
We know he can do crazy.
But goddamn, that Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh, he does, man. He does a special type of crazy.
I mean, he busted out that Daniel Day-Lewisery.
He did.
Goddamn, dude.
Oh, I did that. Bill the Butcher is so awesome. He walks around with that fucking skull cap and his goddamn knives and just... Ah,
yeah, being all intense.
Yep.
2002. It won Best Actor BAFTA for Daniel Day-Lewis. How did it not win the Oscar? Who won that year?
Yeah, who won the Daniel Day-Lewis Award for Daniel Day-Lewisery that year?
Yeah, that's ridiculous. Who the hell could it have been? And then he won Golden Globe Award for Best Director, Best Original Song for U2. That's how you know the Golden Globes are bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
All right, gave U2 a goddamn award for that piece of shit. It's just so Bono and Thiege could show up at the award ceremony.
You'd be like, hey.
Then won the SAG for SAG Best Actor went to Daniel Day-Lewis, which that one.
Daniel Day-Lewis.
The actors are voting on that one. This is the Screen Actors Guild, so. But yeah. Amazing, amazing movie, epic movie. DiCaprio, you know, not his strongest work, I would say. He's good in it, but he does kind of get swallowed up by The Butcher. But a lot of people
do. Lewis, good lord, you can't.
But I mean, Liam Neeson holds his own against. That opening scene with Liam Neeson. Yeah. Shit.
Yeah. He held his own.
That's the movie that should have been made. The movie that should have been made should have been the
Liam Neeson, Bill the Butcher. Somebody talk to somebody. Do this. They're both still alive.
We should. Yeah.
Neeson's is getting older by the day, but we know he can do action
because these two guys are total badasses. Yeah. Brendan Gleeson, he's got a couple of square off scenes with Bill the Butcher where, you know, he's a big imposing dude.
He's in his shillelagh.
And he's got his big ass fucking shillelagh with all the notches on it. Yeah. And then there's that scene with the Fiddlin' Bens. You call me a Fiddlin' Ben? You know, it's a fun movie. It's good. Oh, and then Cameron Diaz is in it. And that's another thing where it's like, no, it's just that I like Cameron Diaz. I do. But she's not the best actress. It's like Winona Ryder in Age of Innocence. You know, it's like, there are other actresses out there. Let's get through some more of these facts here real quick. We talked about storyboarding, The Bad, Freddy Number 11, John Hinckley, watched Taxi Driver a lot. His mom, Catherine, is in a whole bunch of movies. He's not allowed to go to Tibet because of China. He has to be Sean Freeze, John Woo, the killer. He taught, because, you know, sometimes these master filmmakers, they get to do classes sometimes, very, very open about sharing the knowledge. He had as students at NYU both Oliver Stone and Spike Lee.
Nice.
At one point, Martin Scorsese was set to direct Clockers.
Really?
Yes. However, he handed directing chores on to Spike Lee himself while staying on as a producer. He was also at one point set to direct Little Shop of Horrors for David Geffen, with Steven Spielberg as executive producer.
Huh.
Ultimately, obviously, it didn't happen, but he claims he wanted to shoot the movie in 3D.
Whoa.
As an homage to Roger Corman type movies. I'll talk about the cameo in Taxi Driver. Save that one for later. Oh, also, 90s movies. He was one of three major directors who have been offered the opportunity to direct Schindler's List.
Nice.
The other two, Roman Polanski and Billy Wilder, who apparently was still alive in the 90s. Billy Wilder is a guy who made a ton of movies in the 40s and 50s. The Apartment is one of his, one of the go-tos. Double Indemnity, I believe, is another one. Scorsese thought Jewish filmmakers should direct the movie. So that's why.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, fair enough, right? Now, Roman Polanski felt he wasn't ready to deal with the painful subject because he himself is a survivor of the Holocaust. His mother was killed in the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And Billy Wilder at that time was retired. And he himself had lost his mother and grandmother in the Holocaust. He is the one who told Spielberg that he should do it himself. Because Spielberg is the one going around to all these people. Will you do it? Will you do it? Will you do it? And Billy Wilder's like, dude, you should.
Bro, just do it yourself. Come on.
You should do it. And you know what? Ended up being pretty smart move, right? Yeah. On everyone's part.
Seriously, right?
After Gangs of New York, the DiCaprio era continues with the biopic. Now, from this point forward, it's pretty easy. The biopic, The Aviator.
Correct.
Howard Hughes.
Crazy peeing in jars.
Peeing in jars, not clipping his toenails, living in a room. Man, that room must have stunk.
Yeah, really bad.
You know? I saw... I mean, this movie is 2000... What? What year was it?
Four.
In the 90s, late 90s, they did a Simpsons episode where Monty Burns opens up the casino, mm-hmm. and then he lives in the casino, and he's like, I have it all. I got the money, I have all the power, I have everything I need. Only thing I have to worry about is germs. And he becomes a germaphobe, and he just lives in the casino in his room, and he gets all Howard Hughes-ish. He grows a huge beard. He's like peeing in jars. He's walking around with tissue boxes on his feet. And I remember seeing that. And then seeing Aviator and be like, I get it. And he's like, we'll fly out of here in my Spruce Moose. And he holds up a little model plane and he tells Smithers to get in. And he's like, that's just a model. I can't get in there. And he pulls out a gun. He's like,
get in.
And then the Aviator, big part of it, is about Howard Hughes building the gigantic plane. and trying to fly it, and then it flies for a second, like it hovers a little bit. It's like, success! Not really, guys, but...
Yeah, whatever.
It's a fun scene. It's a crazy movie. It's another biopic. Again, the guy loves biopics. Did it win any awards? We got a Best Supporting Actress for Cate Blanchett as Katharine Hepburn, I believe. Right?
Yeah.
It won for Best Art Direction, Best Cinematography, Costume Design, Film Editing. Again, Thelma Schoonmaker. I knew the name would come back up. And Best Film at the BAFTA. Cate Blanchett won again the BAFTA. And a bunch of those awards too. So, it's a damn good movie. And again, it's Scorsese has more aspects of him, his love of cinema, his history of cinema. Portions of the movie are shot with like film stock that was used at that time, and like processed with chemicals that were used from that time. You wanted to replicate.
Everything
as much as possible. So the movie took place, this scene was in the 40s. He was using like tricolor, you know, whatever. So that's why I like throughout the movie, if you really pay attention to the different colors, they change subtly. Like the blues all of a sudden become more blue, and then they get flat, and then they, you know, become kind of like bluish green, maybe, you know. It's little things that shows, you know, when you pay attention to details like that, usually the bigger picture is gonna fall right in line. Great movie. Alec Baldwin's in it.
Yeah.
Guy's a douchebag, but he's fantastic in it. As a Spanish guy named Juan, who ran Pan Am.
Yeah.
Again, whitewashing of history. Whitewashing.
Whitewash white face.
That was followed by The Departed.
Correct, 2006.
Again, DiCaprio with Matt Damon. The remake.
Jack Nicholson.
Of the Chinese film Infernal Affairs. Jack Nicholson. Pretty much his last great movie, because he did a few after that. About Schmidt was either before or after that, but still, that was pretty much the end of Jack Nicholson's run, who's now officially retired.
Mm-hmm.
And man, I mean, it's The Departed. It's a great movie. It's a fucking cop thriller, undercover cop thriller. It's suspenseful.
Yeah.
It's probably one of the more mainstream movies that he's made throughout his career. When you think about it, because it is very forward, like here. Here's a cop who's undercover in a crime world, and here's a criminal who's undercover in a cop world.
Yep.
Boom. You know, inherent drama right there. Action. Go. And then it's all just, the movie's just driving forward. There's humor. Mark Wahlberg has that small part where he's pretty awesome in it, right?
Like, yeah.
Again, Alec Baldwin. Again, small but awesome role for him. Now, the thing is with The Departed. The Departed. It won a shit ton of awards, including... Finally, for Scorsese, Best Picture and Best Director.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like one of those things where it's like, okay, this is for...
We owe it to him.
This is for Taxi Driver and Raging Bull and Goodfellas. This is for all the, quote, mistakes or whatever. You know, because The Departed, it's good.
But it's not the best that he's done.
I wouldn't say it's the best. I mean, 2006, I think that was the same year The Prestige came out. I think I like The Prestige more than like The Departed.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a damn good movie. But like I said, Casino sitting on top of my TV. Another Departed right now.
Yeah.
I got a Departed around here somewhere. It's here. Also, it won Best Adapted Screenplay for William Monahan. That guy's a writing beast. He wrote Kingdom of Heaven.
Yeah.
Right. Thelma Schoonmaker. Back.
Yep.
Editor. And then I won a bunch of other Golden Globe for Best Director. Stop trying to be relevant, Golden Globes. You guys suck. You're the worst. You know what? And then it was also such a giveaway. It's like they knew. They say that no one knows. The presenters don't even know that they put the awards in envelopes, and it's a company, and it's ultimate secrecy, blah, blah, blah. Everyone finds out when they open the fucking envelope, right?
Yeah.
But somehow, the people, the presenters that year for Best Director were, and I remember as clear as fucking day, the presenters were fucking... Steven Spielberg,
mm-hmm.
George Lucas, Francis Ford Coppola. Three buddies, contemporaries, three guys that
they're
all
just
won
like,
before.
Hey, buddy, get up here.
Get up here, buddy. Finally, you're joining the club, man. You belong up here with us. You know, I mean,
yeah.
They knew what they were doing. What if they went up there like, and the award goes to Ang Lee? Mr. Lee, here you go. Here's your award. Brokeback Mountain was fantastic. Thank you very much. Oh, that was a different year, but anyway. So, I mean, it seems kind of bullshit, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, it was cool that they did that. It's a nice gesture. Gesture? How do you say that?
Gesture.
I've only seen it in writing. I've never actually said it out loud before. And, It's, yeah, I mean, it's good, but it's definitely a makeup award.
It is.
You know, it's almost like a lifetime achievement type of thing. Speaking of which, he did win some sort of lifetime. I had that in some. After The Departed.
The Departed.
After The Departed. Back with DiCaprio. Shutter Island.
Correct. 2010.
That's more of a pulpy type thing. I remember reading very recently that Shutter Island, he only made that because, like, he had a couple of projects, like, in the air. Because, you know, when you're making movies, no project ever just gets made. You know, these directors usually have two or three irons in the fire, and then when one of them is, like, ready to go, it's like, all right, now I'm going to jump on this one. You know? And it was at a point where he was trying to do something else. He might have been at that point working on The Winter Frankie Machine, which is, again, a biopic, and it's about a real-life mobster, but in his the winter of Frankie Machine. It's his last days, you know, as an old man. And that's supposed to be his return to the gangster genre with De Niro, because De Niro's going to play Frankie Machine. Big deal. But just for years, it hasn't been made. I think they were getting close to that time. It fell through. Shutter Island was a possibility. DiCaprio was like, we could do this. This will be fun. Because for some reason at that time, DiCaprio was going through a thing where it's like, I got to be about a grieving father who's always like about his kids or something. Because he did that in Inception and Revolutionary Road.
And it was all a little crazy, too. A little
yeah,
little
and always a little crazy. In every role, also. Yeah. That's a great point. DiCaprio, dude. I mean, you're not even married,
man. He was going through a crazy spell.
He was going through something. There were some issues. He was working some issues out. So he got into Shutter Island. It's his first kind of horror film since Cape Fear. Because it's really just... When it comes to horror, it's just Cape Fear and Shutter Island. And even then, neither movie is like a horror movie that you would think of right away.
They're just a little scary.
They're just a little tense. They're closer to psychological thrillers. Yeah. Especially Shutter Island, right? Shutter Island, I think, unfortunately, suffers from the whole post-M. Night Shyamalan thing, where it's like...
Yeah, because there's the
twist. Everyone's looking for the twist. You're expecting a twist. If a twist happens, you're like, oh, twist, you know, blah, blah. Yeah. And that's not a movie where you're not supposed to be looking for a twist. It's, I don't know, it's weird how that's how we watch movies these days. A lot of people, they can't just watch the movie as it is.
Yeah.
But you know, that's what happens. Good movie though. I really enjoy it. Jackie Earle Haley's in it as a crazy guy in a cell.
Mark Ruffalo's in
Mark
it.
Mark Ruffalo being all Ruffalo-y. It's funny that all his characters are always like ruffled, and he's Mark Ruffalo. It's very strange how that worked out for him. But it's true, though.
Yeah.
It's true. It's a good movie. It's a pulpy movie. Didn't win shit. I do remember that movie was supposed to come out like in October or November of what year did it come out?
2010.
It was supposed to come out like November 2009. So they started putting the trailers for it like summer of 2009. And then as it got, for whatever reason, it got closer to release date. Bumped it to February of 2010. So that was like another 4 months of fucking trailers for it. Ended up being one of the highest grossing opening weekends in a February ever, especially for an R-rated movie. But that's because it's a Scorsese movie come out in February with DiCaprio, and we had to sit through 7 months of trailers.
Yeah.
Damn sure.
We're going to see it.
People knew about this fucking movie. Paul Schrader wrote the script for Taxi Driver, but he gave it to Brian De Palma, director of Scarface. Mm-hmm. Brian De Palma gave the screenplay to De Niro. Not to De Niro. To Scorsese. He made Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
Because it was written. Meanwhile, for a little while there, Scorsese contemplated doing a remake of Scarface.
Interesting.
With Robert De Niro. Obviously, that didn't happen.
No.
I think I will save the rest of these for after. Okay, after The Departed, and then after Shutter Island, he did one more DiCaprio, right? Didn't he?
I'm thinking hard.
Not in between. I said this would be easier. Why is it now eluding me?
2011.
Really?
In 3D.
There was nothing between those? He went to Hugo?
Yep. No, I mean, documentaries, he started Boardwalk Empire.
He was Boardwalk Empire. Yeah, that's actually a pretty big deal. He did the pilot for that.
Yeah.
Only episode of Boardwalk Empire that I've seen. And it's pretty much a little Martin Scorsese movie.
Yeah, it is.
It's pretty great. It's pretty awesome. The fantastic Hugo, in 3D. I did see it in 3D because if Martin Scorsese is going to do a movie in 3D, I'm going to fucking be there.
Yeah.
And he's the type of guy who he's really working the gimmick. You know, he's using the tool as much as possible and in all the right ways. And it kind of works that he used it because... have you seen Hugo?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so there's, you know, obviously a big part of the movie is about this character who is Georges Méliès. And he's like one of the, you know, considered one of the founders, fathers of cinema, the moving pictures. And they also have a bit in the movie, if you'll remember, about the Lumiere brothers doing public exhibitions of their film, A Train Arriving at a Station. Mm-hmm. And A Train Arriving at a Station is like a 12 or 15 second short film, black and white, obviously, because that's what they shot back then, of a train just
arriving at the station.
Arriving at the station. The camera is set up on the platform, and so the train is coming sort of at you, sort of at the screen, right? And he shows this in the movie, and it apparently did happen a lot, where people were watching a short film, and they jumped out of the way when the train got to, like, oh my god, here comes the train! You know? It was 3D before it was 3D.
No.
And then Scorsese, he makes a 3D movie that then features a scene in which a train is crashing through a train station, and it's, like, coming out, and there's scenes where it's coming at you, you know? So, I mean, it's, again, a recurring theme. His love of cinema is... it's an homage to history, to cinema's history in the past.
A homage.
He's been a huge proponent of preservation of film and movies, you know, because we lost like 50% of the movies made before 1950 or something like that.
Yeah, was it because of the film it was on?
The film it was on, people just didn't treat it. It was treated as disposable, very disposable entertainment. Like, oh, you spend all this time making a movie, and we showed it a few times, now throw it away. Or here comes the war, we need boot heels.
Yeah.
Give me all the film. We're melting this shit down, right? Yep. Actually, that's in Hugo. They mentioned that in Hugo, right? So it's a great movie. It's a family movie. As we see now, going through his filmography, film by film, it's his first fucking family movie in his entire career.
Yeah.
It's the first movie he could make that like his grandkids could watch or whatever, you know? And it's good. It's really good. I like it quite a bit. So, Hugo. And then finally, Wolf of Wall Street.
Back with Mr. DiCaprio.
Back with DiCaprio. Wolf of Wall Street is just damn good.
Yeah.
It's so good. I mean, it's wild. And you know what? It's interesting looking at now that we're going through these movies, movie by movie. Wolf of Wall Street has, like, Scorsese on coke levels of energy to it.
Yeah.
The way the movie's made. It's a 3-hour movie, and it's fucking fast. It's like... There's like editing tricks and camera moves as like something that like a younger man would think of, someone you would imagine as a much more energetic person.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like 70-year-old fucking Scorsese,
yes,
kicking everyone's ass cinematically,
yes,
showing him that he still knows how it's done. He can still do it. It's a pretty damn incredible film.
And then can you tell the future, Chris? Because IMDb can.
IMDb, just so people know, IMDb is sort of the equivalent of Wikipedia that anyone can update it. So let's see, what does IMDb say? You mentioned it often. I forgot what you said.
He has an untitled Bill Clinton documentary. Apparently.
Untitled Bill Clinton documentary.
That's in post production.
It was in post house. Well, you know what? He makes a lot of documentaries.
An untitled HBO rock and roll project that he's filming apparently right now.
Oh, it's filming.
It's filming.
That's got to be another documentary. This guy works, man.
In 2015, he has a movie called Silence. It's in pre-production, apparently.
Silence, yeah. Silence is one. I remember reading about Silence. That's another one where he's... it's an adaptation of a book, I believe. He's been looking at for a while. And I think it's... That one's going to be more along the lines of like a Kundun type thing, where it's like about a monk or some shit, you know? It's, yeah. Interesting choice.
Apparently, Sinatra has been announced.
Oh, really? Just announced? Yeah, we'll see. We'll see about that. Yeah, I don't know about that. I want to see this Winter of Frankie Machine. This movie he would have made with De Niro. For Hugo, going back to the awards, Hugo did win the Oscar for Best Art Direction, Cinematography, Sound Mixing, Sound Editing, and Visual Effects. Like Gravity, it won a whole bunch of technical stuff. And Wolf of Wall Street didn't win shit. So Scorsese himself got some awards. In 1997, he received the AFI Life Achievement Award.
Nice.
In 98, the Life Achievement Award in 97. He made like 8 more movies since then. His life wasn't done. In 98, AFI placed 3 of his movies on their list of greatest movies in America. Raging Bull at 24. Taxi Driver at 47. and Goodfellas at 94.
Nice.
Yeah. On January 18, 2001, he received the Order of Merit of the Italian Republic.
Okay.
So I guess that means he's like a knight of Italy?
Something like
he's,
that.
He's an Italian knight?
Sure. Because, you know, we still have knights.
January 5th, 2005, at a ceremony in Paris, France, Martin Scorsese was awarded the French Legion of Honor.
Okay.
Recognition of his contribution to cinema. That's out of French.
Cinema.
That's out of French state. Cinema. February 8, 2006, 48th Annual Grammy Awards. He was awarded the award, the Grammy Award for Best Long Form Music Video for No Direction Home. I think that's Bob Dylan. It was either for a Bob Dylan documentary. Yeah, it's for a Bob Dylan documentary. Then pretty sure. No Direction. September 11, 2007, Kennedy Center Honors Committee recognized Scorsese as one of their honorees for the year. January 17, 2010, he got the Golden Globe Cecil B. DeMille Award. Again, Golden Globes is bullshit. September 18, 2011, he won the Primetime Emmy for directing for Boardwalk Empire.
Nice.
And February 12, 2012, the BAFTA Awards, British Academy Film Awards, gave him the Academy Fellowship Award, which I assume is some sort of overall. Yeah, you're pretty awesome. Here's an award for being cool.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Going back to these, let's finish off these Scorsese facts. Scorfax. He was voted fourth greatest director of all time by Entertainment Weekly, making him the only living person in the top five, as well as the only working film director in the top ten.
Thanks.
As at that time, Ingmar Bergman was retired. He spurns the notion of the director's cut. He feels that once a film has been completed, it should not be further altered in any way. The complete opposite of his buddy George Lucas. Lucas famously visited Scorsese on the set of Gangs of New York. That's what these guys have done for years and years and years, going back to when they were really young. They hang out with each other when they're making movies. If they can get away, they'll visit each other on set just to see what's up.
Yeah.
Scorsese took him around. He had, you know, a whole 5 points, New York City, the five points set built.
Yeah.
So he has this massive set, and they're up on a hill, and they're looking over everything, and it's you know, incredible detail. It's fantastic. And George Lucas reportedly turns to him and says, you know, you can do all this with computers, right?
Mm. Punch him in the face, Martin. Punch him right in the face.
He did, with his cinematic cock, because who loves the Star Wars prequel movies? No one. Who loves Scorsese movies?
I do.
A lot of people. So, his favorite films include Citizen Kane, The Red Shoes, and The Leopard. I have not seen The Leopard. The Red Shoes is fantastic, and obviously Citizen Kane is fucking Citizen Kane. When asked where audiences would find the next Martin Scorsese, what do you think he said?
I don't know.
Wes Anderson.
Really?
Yes. Yes, this was shortly after Rushmore.
Okay.
The Aviator, his first movie to make $100 million in the U.S. This huge story, amazing career full of fantastic films.
He's a big hit, buddy.
It took until The Aviator for one of his movies to make $100 million. The Wolf of Wall Street is his highest grossing film. His latest movie, most financially successful, $389 million worldwide.
God damn. It's all money.
This is a little funny, a little anecdote here. As a teenager in the Bronx, Scorsese frequently rented Michael Powell's The Tales of Hoffman from a store that only had one copy. When it wasn't available, the owner told him, "That Romero kid has it," referring to George A. Romero, who's also a fan of the film. Today, both directors cite the film as a major influence.
And apparently they were both watching the same copy.
The same copy at the same time. The Tales of Hoffman. So that's one that people should check out. He served as a guest critic on Siskel and Ebert following the death of Gene Siskel. And the episode was the best films of the 90s. Roger Ebert cited Goodfellas as one of the best of the 90s. Scorsese's, and he put it at number three. He said the third best film of the 90s was Scorsese's Goodfellas. Scorsese's top 10 of the 90s. You ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
Number 10 was a tie. So he actually did 11. He cheated, which I can get with.
Yeah.
Malcolm X and Heat.
Okay.
Number 9, Fargo.
Okay.
Number 8, Crash. Cronenberg's Crash. Yeah. Not the racist Crash, because that wasn't invented yet. That
whole movie didn't come out yet. So, wow, man.
That's a crazy movie to have in your top 10 there.
Man.
Number 7.
Marty, what's up in your head, homie?
Number 7, Wes Anderson's Bottle Rocket.
Bottle Rocket's fun.
Number 6, Breaking the Waves.
Never heard of it.
Don't know that one. Number 5, Bad Lieutenant with his buddy Harvey Keitel.
Yeah.
Number 4, Eyes Wide Shut.
Okay.
It's Kubrick's
final.
Denouement.
Yeah.
Number 3, a movie called Duo Sang. And then it says parentheses, A Borrowed Life. So I believe it's a Chinese film. Duo Sang. Number 2, Terrence Malick's The Thin Red Line.
Okay. That was a great movie.
And number 1, The Horse Thief. I haven't seen it. I think it's an Italian film.
Okay.
He attended Cardinal Hayes High School in the Bronx as a young man. Other Cardinal Hayes High School's alumni? George Carlin, Regis Philbin, basketball player Jamal Mashburn. In the 90s, I had a pair of Mashburns. Nice. They were black with little purple highlights on them. And writer Don DeLillo. The first movie he saw in the cinema was Duel in the Sun at the age of 4. You remember seeing it? Do you remember the first movie you saw? What's the first movie you do remember seeing?
Die Hard 2.
Die Hard 2. Interesting. That's 90? About that. 90, maybe 91.
Sounds like 7.
Die Hard 2. Yeah, you should not have been in that.
No, my dad took me to see it. It was awesome.
Your dad's a good man.
I saw the fucking the ice pick scene.
Yes.
And I was just, not the ice, but the icicle scene.
The icicle in the eye.
And I was just like, this is awesome.
That is awesome. I can't remember my first movie, but I do remember seeing. I can't remember which came first. I was either going to see Back to the Future 2 or Batman, which was 89. Okay. They might have both been 89. And then also around that time, I think it was 1990, was when Brain Donors came out, the John Turturro movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that one, that's the first comedy I remember seeing. And that movie slayed me when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And it slays me to this day. What does it say about me? I don't know. On Inside the Actor's Studio, he said the directors that inspired him the most are John Cassavetes. It used to be on Netflix, that Killing of a Chinese Bookie.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably on Hulu now because they have all the Criterion movies. Orson Welles. Duh. John Ford, you know, another huge filmmaker back in the day. Fellini, yeah. Elia Kazan, Roberto Rossellini, and the directing team of Michael Power and Emmerich Pressburger. They were like the Lord Miller of their day, where everything they touched was fucking good. All of his films from 1972 to 1990 shot in 1.85 by 1 aspect ratio, which is like, it's widescreen, but it's still a tighter rectangle.
Okay.
All of his movies from 1992 onward. So that's what was after we just what was after Goodfellas.
I
already forgot. That was all shot in CinemaScope, 2.35 by 1. So that's a really wide scope, the anamorphic wide frame, which is, you know, I prefer that. It's beautiful. And this little factoid delights me to no end. And it's if I ever get to meet the guy, I can only talk to him about one thing. This would be the thing that I talk to him about. He is a huge fan of Fawlty Towers.
Nice.
He describes the episode The Germans as, quote, so tasteless, it's hilarious. So we can talk about Fawlty Towers all day and Martin Scorsese.
John Cleese is awesome.
John Cleese is awesome. Just mutual love for John Cleese. The guy's incredible. He knows more. He's forgotten more about movies than I could ever hope to learn. That anyone can ever hope to learn. He is a walking film library, an encyclopedia. He's a goddamn American treasure. He's a world treasure, worldwide treasure. And he should be loved and adored. And maybe even in some circles worshipped.
Okay.
I fully endorse that. It's Scorsese.
Are you going to start the cult of Scorsese?
The cult of the Scorsese. The Scorsese cult. Score culty. Cult Sezzy.
Eh, it sounds a little better. Getting closer, Chris.
Let me workshop this one out. I'll get back to you.
All right.
On the official name of the Cult of Scorsese. The Cult of Martin Scorsese. How about that? All right, well, that was the first film school where we just went by movie by movie. We talked about it a little bit. I don't know if we actually learned anything about actual films, but hey, maybe someone out there learned something. I would hope so.
Probably not.
We threw a lot of shit out there.
Uh-huh.
Maybe something stuck.
Nah.
Well, we'll come back. We'll come back with another edition. We'll come back with David Fincher. I'm going to do for sure. That's the next one. I'm going to do a David Fincher one. That's going to be an interesting one. A lot of talking about violent sex and murder and Nine Inch Nails.
All of those things I like. I guess.
Well, then,
because I'm a fan of all of his work, most of it.
Well, then I'm sure you'll have a lot of input for that episode. So looking forward to that. That'll be sometime next month. Hope you guys enjoyed the first ever Crespo Diso Film School. I'm your host, Christopher Crespo, with Drew Sagagra and Drew,
dude.
I'll try and give you a big outro there. A big one.
Thanks.
Hey, just trying to be a good guy. Plus, the soundboard's not on, so I couldn't really access the applause.
Clap, 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 clap.
How about a Seinfeld type outro? Boom, 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 boom.